Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. We're a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle, Washington. I'm your host, John O'Brien. On this episode, Seattle Arts and Lectures finished its most recent poetry series with a visit from multiple award-winning poet Terrence Hayes. About his work, poet Cornelius Eady says, "First you'll marvel at his skill, his near-perfect pitch, his disarming humor, his brilliant turns of phrase. Then you'll notice the grace, the tenderness, the unblinking truth-telling just beneath his lines, the open and generous way he takes in our world." Seattle Arts and Lectures poetry curator Rebecca Hoog says Hayes' work is fluid, resists genre, and shrugs off easy categorization. Terrence Hayes is the author of 5 volumes of poetry, including his latest, How to Be Drawn. He won the National Book Award for Poetry for his volume, Lighthead. He has been the recipient of fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Guggenheim Foundation, and the MacArthur Foundation. His work has appeared in 3 Best American Poetry collections. Hayes currently teaches at the University of Pittsburgh. Terrence Hayes appeared at Chihuly Garden and Glass in the Seattle Center on May 5, 2015. Here he presents his lecture, The Poetics of Liquid. This event was presented by Seattle Arts and Lectures, the Bagley Wright Lecture Series on Poetry, the Seattle Times, and KUOW 94.9. Thanks to Anna Tatashev for our recording.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Rebecca Hoogs, and I'm the Associate Director of Seattle Arts and Lectures. I'm delighted to welcome you. Thank you. I'm delighted to welcome you to a talk by Terrence Hayes, presented in partnership with the Bagley Wright Lecture Series on Poetry. Tonight is a big night. It's our finale of this year's poetry series. It's Cinco de Mayo, and today's Give Big. If you have already given to Sal today, thank you. And if you have not already given big today, I encourage you to keep us in mind as midnight ticks near. Everything we do here is made possible by generous supporters like you. And speaking of everything we do, I'm delighted to begin tonight's festivities by announcing what we'll do next year. Our literary arts series will begin on October 6th with Elizabeth Gilbert, author of Eat, Pray, Love, last year's novel, The Signature of All Things, and the forthcoming Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear. We'll continue on October 29th by featuring Ta-Nehisi Coates. Coates is a senior editor for The Atlantic and blogger for that publication's website. His next book, Between the World and Me, Notes on the First 150 Years in America, will be published in October. Our third speaker is a fellow who just happened to win the Pulitzer Prize a couple weeks ago, Anthony Doerr. Every sentence of All the Light We Cannot See is gorgeously crafted, and the story is heartbreakingly beautiful. Our fourth speaker on January 28th will be Geraldine Brooks. Brooks' novel, March, won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction in 2005, and she has a new book coming out in the fall, The Secret Chord, which is a work of historical fiction about King David. And hot off the curatorial presses just today is a new edition. Emily St. John Mandel will speak on March 23rd. She's the Canadian author of 4 books, including most recently Station 11, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. And our literary art series will close on April 21st with author Teju Cole. Cole is a Nigerian-American writer, photographer, and art critic, and he's author of 2 novels, and he's the newly appointed photography critic for the New York Times Magazine. We are also so excited to be launching a new 3-part series next year in partnership with Hedgebrook and sponsored by Women's Funding Alliance. And we'll kick off that series. The series is called Women You Need to Know, and we'll kick it off on October 22nd with graphic novelist and comic artist Alison Bechdel. A MacArthur Genius Award winner, she's the author of You Are You My Mother and Fun Home, which has been made into a musical which just opened on Broadway to rave reviews, including 12 Tony nominations. 2 more events will be added later this spring, so stay tuned. In our special events division, we'll be bringing The Moth back to Seattle on May 18th. And in our Hinge series, we'll kick off the year with poet musician and actor Saul Williams reading from his new book of poems. Now on to the poetry series. Last but not least, on November 10th, we'll feature Linda Paston. Linda is the author of 12 books of poetry, including a 13th out this coming fall. Her work has focused on marriage, parenting, and grief, and her work has twice been nominated for the National Book Award. On December 1st, we'll continue our partnership with the Bagley Wright Lecture Series to present Srikanth Reddy to give a talk on poetry. Reddy is the author of 2 books of poetry, Facts for Visitors and Voyager. His talk will consider a range of questions concerning poetry and poetics, including theories of likeness, ekphrasis, technology, and wonder. In April, National Poetry Month, we'll present a celebration of Pablo Neruda in collaboration with Copper Canyon Press. This event will feature readings and conversation by a panel of translators and luminaries on the importance of the great Chilean poet. And on May 13th, we will close out our season by featuring one of the most talked about poets of this year, Claudia Rankine. Rankine is the author of the acclaimed book Citizen, an American Lyric, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award in Poetry and was a finalist in criticism, making it the first book in the award's history to be a double nominee. There are 2 more events in the works, so stay tuned. And a note about space, next year's poetry series, will be held not here, but just a stone's throw from here at the Nesholm Family Lecture Hall. This is the smaller space in Macaw Hall. It has the right mix of size, perfect sound, comfy seats, great sight lines, and easy parking. But before we leave here, I do want to ask you to join me in extending enormous thanks to Chihuly Gardening Glass for providing us the most stunning backdrop for this year's poetry series. And as for subscriptions, they are on sale now. It will be an incredible year, and it wouldn't be the same without you, so I hope to see you there. Now back to tonight. Our partner for this evening, the Bagley Wright Lecture Series on Poetry, was founded by Charlie Wright in memory of his late father, the businessman and philanthropist Bagley Wright. The series is directed by Wave Books Editor-at-Large Matthew Zapruder. The Bagley Wright Lecture Series provides leading poets with the opportunity to explore in depth their own thinking on the subject of poetry and poetics, and through financial and logistical support, to arrange for the delivery of several lectures that result from these investigations. Lectures are delivered publicly in regular partnership with several institutions, including the Library of Congress, New York University, Harvard University, and the Poetry Foundation. We are immensely proud to be the Seattle home for the lectures and to be part of bringing this new thinking into the world. The lecture series has a mailing list, which I encourage you to join, and their sign-up is on Sal's information table. In addition to the Bagley Wright Lecture Series, I would like to thank our presenting sponsor, the Seattle Times, our series sponsor, Charles and Barbara Wright, our organizational supporters, all of whom are listed in our program, and special thanks for significant support go to For Culture, Amazon.com, Arts Fund, Boeing, Elizabeth George Foundation, Harvest Foundation, Medina Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Norcliffe Foundation, Nordstrom, Petunia Foundation, the Seattle Office of Arts and Culture, and the Washington State Arts Commission. Many thanks to our media sponsors, Crab Creek Review, Poetry Northwest, City Arts, King FM, KUOW, KPLU, Seattle Met, and The Stranger. And thanks to our bookstore partner, Open Books. The format for this evening will be a lecture by Terrence Hayes, followed by a Q&A. And if you have a question, please write it on the card in your program and pass it to an usher. After the event, Terrence's signature will be available at the book signing table. To begin our event, I'm delighted to present a Writers in the School student from Garfield High School, Latasia Coverson, an 11th grader at Garfield High School, where she worked this year with WITS writer Aaron Counts. Please join me in welcoming Latasia Coverson.
Hello. Hi. My name's Latasia, and my poem today that I'm going to be reading is called Titles. Give me the title. I'll take it. I'll take whatever shots you blow at me, hate you show on me, pity you have on me, because you don't have anything on me. Call me all out my name, make comments on how I'm framed, put me out there in the open like a picture on a frame. You framed me, but I trusted you, so I guess I'm the one to blame when it's all said and done. Give me the title. Please do. Just like when your mama told your daddy her son was you, I'll run with that too. Yes, you might have heard. I got a couple skeletons in my closet, but you unsure, so let me check you like you was HIV positive. I'm liable to put you in order, no need for a contact order. I'm doing this for all the unborn daughters, soon to be deadbeat fathers and mothers who said forget a title, but may my daughter carry a Bible. May my son treat her like a princess because he was raised by a queen. All whose kingdom turned their back on her because of a title. A title that made mama play papa and papa play no role. Boy, son, leader, those are roles too. But you rather play dumb and ignorant to the fact that mother's at home explaining to daughter how mother is daddy, mommy is daddy, but mommy is still mommy. She's just taking on another title. That girl, she's a thought, but here's a thought, she's more than that. She's smart, outgoing, and her future is glowing. But that title, she can't seem to shake. Because you won't seem to let it go, let her go. It was a mistake. She thought she loved him. She thought that maybe he loved her too. After this, he would soon. Yes, she's a thought because she was thinking much more besides one, but two. You took from her, but all you did. No, sorry. She gave to you, but all you did was take from her, you greedy fool. You men, or shall we say lack thereof, lacking your presence, lacking a father figure, a role model. You're the only one in need of a title. Thank you.
No pressure, Terrence. It is rare that I have the pleasure of getting to introduce someone twice, as I try each year to bring new poets to the series. But when the Bagley Wright Lecture Series on Poetry let me know that Terrence Hayes, who appeared in our series back in 2011, was one of this year's fellows and asked if we'd have him back in the guise of lecturer, I jumped at the chance. Any opportunity to hear this mind live is one to seize as often as it is offered. Now the author of 5 books of poetry, including the just published How to Be Drawn, Terrence Hayes has amassed a hefty array of awards for his work, including a National Book Award and a MacArthur Genius Grant. In reviewing his new book for this week's New Yorker, Dan Chasen wrote that Hayes, quote, is a poet of swallowed garrulity, imagined riposte, mock correction, and interior litigation. Hayes's poems are like a Pixar version of the mental marionette show, a dazzling space with comic jabs. What his poems also are is exemplified by what he will talk about tonight, the poetics of liquid. His work is fluid, resists genre, shrugs off easy categorization. They resist aboutness. As he has said, quote, a poem is never about one thing. You want it to be as complicated as your feelings. It's funny, when we say that a poem is good, sometimes we say that it's working, as if it's all business. I'd rather say, and I'd argue that Hayes's poems say that when a poem is good, it's playing. It's off the clock and hook good. Across invented forms and pulling from a huge range of sources, music, photographs, art, his life, our lives, Hayes seriously plays in that play for mortal stakes sort of way. I saw on Facebook earlier today that Pat Sajak and Vanna White of Wheel of Fortune were in this very room earlier today. Isn't it strange that one space can hold both that and this in the breadth of 12 hours? That it can hold them and us? Isn't that wonder and strangeness like Hayes' very own poems? Even today's weather was the essence of liquid modernity. Splashy sunshine, rays of rain. It was a day that couldn't decide what genre of weather it wanted to be. It was uncertain, unpredictable, changeable as a mind, as a poem's direction. We are fortunate that the Wheel of Fortune spun in such a way that we landed here tonight to sit in the downpour of the ideas of Terence Hayes so that we could all not know where we are going together and be soaked through to the bone and be glad. Please join me in welcoming the unpredictable and utterly delightful weather of Terence Hayes.
All right, how y'all doing?
Thanks, Latasia. That was good, girl.
When you're up here and you screw up, it seems terrible, but it just makes you human. It's better when you mess up. I'm saying that for myself. So. It's better when it's not perfect. So that was great. I love your recovery. I love language, the attitude, all of it. Rebecca, I'm not very good with manners, so I have to, more than the essay I was thinking about, I got to make sure I thank everybody. Rebecca, thanks for the introduction and always being a great host. Matthew, thanks, man, for coming all the way up from San Francisco and leaving your beautiful boy and being a good friend. And Charlie, great personality, the whole family. Thank y'all telling me about your kids and their adventures and marriages and bad girlfriends. So, yeah, man, it's been a good day. I feel like I've been here a week. All right. So this is the deal. I'm generally pretty casual, but that can be dangerous in this kind of setting. So what I thought I would do is just like be very serious and only look down and only read this like it was a script. Because otherwise we'll be here like 12 hours instead of 6. So I'm going to try to be serious. And then when Rebecca comes up, I'll be back to myself. So let me see. Although it's not a serious thing. There's a bunch of stuff in here. This is kind of the intro, the setup for you guys. I just wrote everything down so I wouldn't look up too much. It was midway through my first lecture, Ideas of Influence, that I realized a term I kept using, liquid poet, was itself enough to harbor much of my thinking. So I wouldn't say I was drowning in the lecture, that first one, but I was at least neck deep. There was a video synopsis of Stephen Johnson's 2010 book, Where Good Ideas Come From. There were several slides of paintings, drawings, graphs. There was some discussion of the poetry of Robert Lowell and Etheridge Knight and Amiri Baraka. There was some talk of the 17th century rhetorician Giambattista Vico's theory of maker's knowledge and contemporary Polish sociologist Zygmunt Bauman's theory of liquid modernity. And there were a few other things I'm forgetting. So it didn't take 40 days. It was still like a 90-minute lecture. So it may interest or terrify you to know that much of the above, minus the audio and visuals, is in fact still here. But I've got, I hope, a more liquid shape for you. What follows remains an exploration of influence, but one that tries as well to account for the nature of uncertainty and sensibility. And I'm calling this the poetics of liquid. So that's kind of like, so I can't do this. I'm already doing it. I shouldn't be looking up. That's kind of the intro, and then we're going to get into the essay. I'm going to try to read it. Don't get set into one form. Adapt it and build your own. Let it grow. Be like water. Empty your mind. Be formless, shapeless like water. Now you put water in a cup, it becomes the cup. You put water into a bottle, it becomes the bottle. You put it in a teapot, it becomes the teapot. Water can flow or it can crash. Be water, my friend. $100 to the person who knows who said that. There you go. Okay. I don't have the money on me right now. Charlie, you don't need it anyway. You know, Charlie's going to give $100 to the other person who guessed it. Everybody knows it? Oh, well, I'm going to take that out of the essay then. A poetics of liquid requires liquid. Influence is at its etymological root fluid from the medieval Latin influentia, inflow, and from the old French, a flow of water. It was in the late 14th century an astrological term, streaming ethereal power from the stars acting upon character or destiny of men. And then by the mid-15th century, it was defined as an exertion of unseen power over other persons. And we still hear from time to time, we hear it as a tangible, immersive, submersive power, like under the influence of booze, of drugs, under the influence of love, of greed, of darkness, of hope, of history. What does it mean to be under the influence of poetry? In her essay collection, oh, I should say, that's a really awesome sign-up, too. You didn't say Marilynne Robinson, but you almost said her because you said all these other great people. Man, I got to come back for that. Ta-Nehisi, he's awesome. Got to check him out, Ta-Nehisi Coates. Anyway, in her essay collection, When I Was a Child, I Read Books, Marilynne Robinson describes God as a sphere with a center but no circumference. And it is, it seems, equally suitable to discuss influence in this way. You sense its presence, but can't exactly say where it begins or ends. Influence is practical. It does not give so much as give way. This, in fact, is how Robert Bly describes water in his poem, Mourning Pablo Neruda, from a 1988 book. So I'm going to read you that poem. I got poems through here because, you know, I got to keep it interesting. So there's a few poems sprinkled through. I'm going to read you this whole poem called Mourning Pablo Neruda by Robert Bly. Water is practical, especially in August. Water fallen into the buckets I carry to the young willow trees whose leaves have been eaten off by grasshoppers. Or this jar of water that lies next to me on the car seat as I drive to my shack. When I look down, the seat all around the jar is dark. For water doesn't intend to give, it gives away. And the jar of water lies there, quivering as I drive through a countryside of granite quarries, stones soon to be shaped into the blocks for the dead. The only thing they have left that is theirs. For the dead remain inside us as water remains in granite, hardly at all. For their job is to go away and not come back, even when we ask them. But water comes to us. It doesn't care about us. It goes around us on the way to the Minnesota River, to the Mississippi, to the Gulf, always closer to where it has to be. No one lays flowers on the grave of water, for it is not here, it is gone. Neruda was a liquid poet, poet of surrealism, poet of historical epics, political poet, erotic poet, but I'm getting ahead of myself. The poem tells us, just as Bruce Lee does, what we sort of already know about the transparent protean styles of water, and Bly's ending alludes or seems to allude to Keats' request that his friend Joseph Severin have the phrase, "Here lies one whose name was writ in water," inscribed on his headstone. You know, the end of that poem is, "No one lays flowers on the grave of water," and I hear in that what's actually written on Keats's headstone in Rome. So a poetics of liquid is certainly influenced by Keats' notion of negative capability. An inability to define negative capability is a pretty good definition of negative capability. So even English majors don't really know what it is. A reaching after uncertainty, a ripple of reliable ambiguity. This is me just making up some definition. A mystery that opens on wave after wave of mystery. Keats did not state it as an explicit poetics when he wrote about it, speaking of Coleridge in a letter to his brothers in 1817. He came up with the theory when he was 22, which either makes him like as smart as God or we're just dumb and we think it sounds smart. I think he probably was as smart as God, Keats. Half as smart, which is still pretty smart. I see, that's what I mean. I'm going to stop. He meant it as a critique, saying, with the great poet, the sense of beauty overcomes every other consideration, or rather obliterates all consideration. Negative capability is either Keats' brilliant premonition of the world to come, our world, or it defines a timeless human state. I realize I am a mystery to myself. How about you? I realize I love mystery. I realize it terrifies me. At once it struck me what quality went into form a man of achievement, especially in literature, and which Shakespeare possessed so enormously, Keats wrote. I mean negative capability, that is, when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. So that's his definition of it. So it influences our discussion, but it is not quite enough to account for a working poetics of liquid. A liquid poetics is as much about uncertainty as it is about mutable sensibility, adaptive temperaments and temperatures and forms. I use poetics here as a noun, but isn't it also an adjective? Other genres may be poetic, novels, sunsets too, poetic character, poetic wind. Is the opposite of poetic prosaic? If poetic is equal to fluid, is prosaic equal to density, an obfuscation or fundamental mud? Is the opposite of poetics, mechanics or mechanistics, a mathematical industrial order? Yes, poetics are not fixed. They are as indescribable and shifty as water. Actually, I don't fully agree when Blas says water is practical at the outset of that poem, Mourning Pablo Neruda. Sure, water is necessary. Water is nutritious, but water can also be a nuisance. It floods, it steams, it freezes, it rots. It doesn't care about us. It goes around us. That's what Bly writes later in the poem. Water has no endgame, no ambition. It is pure procedure. Likewise, one's poetics are most evident in procedure and practice. One's poetics should be liquid. Be water, my friend. And that's the end of the lecture. I'm kidding. That's a 10-minute lecture. I do say here, I could just about end my lecture with that. And y'all started clapping, too. We got at least another 3 hours to go. Except I haven't mentioned Zygmunt Bauman, who, born in Poland in 1925, has been old for a very long time. After 50-plus books wrestling with postmodernity, he devised in the 2000 book, Liquid Modernity, a means accounting for liquidity in its application to the form of life currently practiced. That's what he says. In the dozen years between that first book in 2000 and its 2012 reissue, he published Liquid Love in 2003, Liquid Life in 2005, Liquid Fear in 2006, as well as Liquid Times, Living in an Age of Uncertainty in 2006. So the links between those books is accounted for in the new introduction of the 2012 reissue. So there's a joke in there, too, with all those liquid titles, but we don't have time for the joke. Bauman writes that, so here we're getting into it, the liquid modern man flows through his own life like a tourist, changing places, jobs, spouses, values, and sometimes even more, such as political or sexual orientation. So that should sound like a lot of people in here, right? He says, individuals must splice together an unending series of short-term projects and episodes that don't add up to the kinds of sequence to which concepts like career or progress could be meaningfully applied. So he's a sociologist, so obviously he really is talking about all of us. These fragmented lives require individuals to be flexible and adaptable, to be constantly ready and willing to change tactics at short notice, to abandon commitments and loyalties without regrets, and to pursue opportunities according to their current availability. So terms like late modernity or post-modernity don't quite account for current when he says it, and all that word connotes. Current as in presentness versus postness or lateness. Current as in movement versus stability. So Bauman and Bauman-style sociologists may well say I'm presenting just the tip of the liquid modernist iceberg. I'm going to tell you a story real quick. So how I learned about him was just at a party, and a sociologist, I was talking about like what I think about, you know, the world and poems, and he was like, oh, that's like, you're a liquid modernist. And so I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. So I looked it up. And then he said something else about me being a vegan, which comes up later. I thought it was an insult. I realized a lecture has a function. It is not simply an archive of thinking. It is important that I have something useful to argue or explain. I realize a lecture should not be a series of realizations. It should be declarations, instructions even. But I'd rather realize than declare. And maybe this makes me a poet. A lecture is not a poem. Moreover, a lecture is not even an essay. Cynthia Ozick defines essay in her essay collection, Portrait of the Essay as a Warm Body, thusly, like a poem, a genuine essay is made out of language and character and mood and temperament and pluck and chance. So a lecture is not an essay. Is a lecture closer to a speech? Are the speeches of MLK sermonic lectures? I don't know, though I realize one should not say I don't know in a lecture. If a lecture concerns poetics, both in general and in the particular case of your lecturer, what is the meaning of instruction? Is the lecturer trying to instruct himself? Is the lecturer trying to instruct the audience in the nuances and beautiful complications of language? I say ignore the borders of genre. If you are a listener to reach for the beautiful complications of language, avoid genre as well as silence. Do not bite your tongue. In the empty house, your children at school, your beloved at work, do not hesitate to speak to yourself in a poetics of the self. And how shall we define a poetics of the self? It may not be of interest to you, but when I was young, 3 or 4 in the military housing of Fort Bragg, North Carolina, where my brother was born, I spent long hours in the basement with a $10 guitar singing and talking to myself. I remember it. A floor above, my mother was also talking to herself. She was only 19 or 20. She could have been talking about no more than wealth or security or the state in which one need no longer talk needfully to the self. I realize it is not lecturing to talk at long lengths about one's mother or oneself. So when I encountered Stephen Johnson's term, liquid network, I thought instantly of Zygmunt Bauman's liquid modernity. Where Good Ideas Come From is Johnson's 2010 book on the nature of creativity. So he offers 7 patterns of innovation, but I want to mention just 3, the adjacent possible pattern, the platform pattern, and the liquid network pattern. The first innovation pattern, this sounds really complicated, which he calls the adjacent possible, is where creativity and new ideas are triggered by the influence of intimate bonds. For you, you could just think about whoever your lover is. In poetry, we might think of the influential friendships like that of Robert Lowell and Elizabeth Bishop. If you're an English major, you know what I'm talking about. Or influential marriages like that of Robert Lowell and his 3 wives, but most especially his 2nd wife, writer Elizabeth Hardwick. Or we could think of Lowell and his mentorship with students like Kathleen Spivak or Sylvia Plath or Anne Sexton. So Robert Lowell was a liquid poet, a poet prone to constant shifts in style and allegiance, maybe hence the 3 wives. So just a quick rundown of his books gives you a sense of this. His 1946 Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Lord's Weary Castle, owes a great deal to the New Critics. Alan Tate and John Crow Ransom were his teachers. His 1959 book, Life Studies, owes a great deal to the bold, bald sort of proto-confessionalism of Allen Ginsberg and the Beats. So in his reminiscences of writing Life Studies, Lowell said he was influenced by hearing Allen Ginsberg howl while doing a number of readings with him on the West Coast. He found himself simplifying his poems, breaking the meter, making impromptu changes at readings. This shaped a steering from his stress on highly crafted poems, a kind of like weird, again, new criticism work from that first book, to poems that strove a breakthrough back into life. So I hope I haven't drifted too far from Where Good Ideas Come From. Johnson mentions the adjacent possible as an essential dynamic in the exchange and influence of ideas between intimates. So I would say, and I'm going to use this analogy for a little while, this sort of metaphor. Imagine like 2 or 3 mates afloat on a small craft or a raft, maybe. That is the adjacent possible. You're really close to each other. You see each other. You're sort of allied in a very intimate relationship. And out of that, like sometimes your partner, lover, spouse will say something really creative, and then later on you say it was you that said it. So I do that all the time. So that's the adjacent possible. And then she says, I said that. And you're like, no, you didn't. Surrounding the adjacent possible is a slightly larger circle of influence Johnson calls the platform innovation pattern. In poetry, we find the platform model is equivalent to the writing workshop happening in colleges or public libraries or living rooms. Places like a writer's conference, like the Bread Loaf Writers Conference or the Kaveh Khanum Retreat for African American Poets or Squaw Valley, I think that's over here on the West Coast. Here, the participants are not always close friends, lovers, intimates. They're more like acquaintances on a houseboat or a ferry. So they see each other, they come to meet each other, but they're, you know, maybe not always sleeping with each other. They're not all sleeping with each other. Finally, surrounding the adjacent possible and the platform spheres is Johnson's liquid network. So the various aforementioned crafts navigate distinct aesthetic areas. So here are some examples of like these liquid networks with these small groups and then sort of medium-sized groups. So like language poets, that would be a liquid network. They all kind of have a similar ambition. They're sort of working to a similar goal. They don't all know each other, but they're loosely aligned. The sea of spoken word poets, same idea. You sort of know it when you hear it. You recognize that they have a shared sort of aesthetic belief. Sea of new formalists, we can kind of keep going. The liquid network is broad enough to hold people who share common interests, beliefs, aesthetics, but don't necessarily interact with each other. So Robert Lowell crossed the borders of various poetic and liquid networks. The confessional school, the beat school, the new critics. He was a liquid poet adapting and borrowing, and as Bauman says, ready and willing to change tactics at short notice, to abandon commitments and loyalties without regret, and to pursue opportunities according to their current availability. His liquidity made his relationship to poets and poetry renewable and sustainable, but it also engendered a certain kind of ethical uncertainty. I could really go on about this. What I say parenthetically is in poems featuring the letters of his soon-to-be ex-wife, Elizabeth Hardwick. So he wrote a book called The Dauphin, and he just put a whole bunch of her letters in it. So that's like, you know, some ethical uncertainty there. So in that other lecture that I told you about at the top, the one drifting a few feet below this one, I went on to discuss the ways Etheridge Knight, poet of the blues, poet of cultural ancestry, prison poet, love poet, was also a liquid poet and one that was closer to my heart. And they're nice enough to have some of his books here tonight, too. I Know Their Styles is a line from his best-known poem, Ideas of Ancestry, and it seems like an appropriate motto for the liquid poet. It suggests his adaptiveness. Knight was both more casual and more calculating than Lowell as he drifted between the liquid poet networks of the black arts poets. He was briefly married to Sonia Sanchez, again, a whole other story we could talk about later. The deep image poets, Robert Bly, who wrote that poem I read earlier, was one of his major champions. And even the academic networks, he toured poeting for a living. And also somebody here said, saw him dancing with I at a party one time. So he was on the scene poeting for a living. Here in Seattle, he saw him dancing with I at a party, and shortly thereafter, probably getting high out back. You know, just smoking a little weed, nothing too dangerous. So the present-day university MFA decreeing system certainly constitutes the largest of our poetry liquid networks these days, though the associated writing program, as they are known, can vary in aesthetics. They share the same systems of evaluation, so how they grade, how they write their essays, and the same systems of confirmation. So the fact that you get a degree, a master's degree, the fact that publication is a very important part, the fact that you're always going for its tenure. So again, not everybody in an MFA program knows everyone, but there is a liquid network that constitutes a kind of shared ideas, shared destinations on the sea of associated writing programs. Knight had no college degree. He dropped out of school at 14 and discovered poetry during his 8-year stint in the Indiana State Prison. But he moved between the community workshops he often held and urban dive bars because he could drink while he was teaching. The bucolic workshops that Robert Bly invented him to up in Maine, the Great Mother Conference, and then the standard workshops like those he taught even when he was on residence at the University of Pittsburgh from 1969 to 1970. So in the 90s, when I was a first-year graduate student at the University of Pittsburgh seeking something beyond the university's workshop platform, I attended a community workshop every third Saturday. The group held no grad students other than myself, though it took place in the university's Black Studies Department, and the department had been launched in the early 70s by Sonia Sanchez when she and Etheridge Knight lived in Pittsburgh. The Country Writers Workshop, as it was called, had once been attended by August Wilson, back when he thought he was going to be a poet. They ran him out of there. They was like, you ain't no poet, man. That's a whole other story. And then, like, he showed them because he said, well, I'll be something else. By the time I showed up in the 90s, Wilson was gone, and maybe in Seattle. But his close friend, Rob Penny, a poet and playwright, was there captaining a motley African-American crew that included an ex-con heroin addict who'd run in his heyday with Etheridge Knight, a few quirky, lusty elderly sisters. Again, a whole other thing about old women when they come to writing poems. Just they get all of that passion out. A few steel mill workers, and this guy, Dane the Demented Wordsmith, who was an aspiring rapper and my closest friend in those years. At 22, I moved to Pittsburgh from South Carolina with almost no resources. I knew no one. I had nothing. I knew nothing. I lived on the instant grits left in the place I house sat in lieu of rent for a summer. I read many of the books that lined the walls. I fed the owner's two cats. I watched her stash of strange lesbian porn. So the women were businesslike, or they were like scholars. The breasts were floppy, but not uninteresting. So I had to reel my way back in. I thought I was going to go off on those tangents. I watched them while my stomach growled. I shed 10 pounds of muscle. I hung out with Dane playing basketball, smoking weed, flirting with his sister. And every third Saturday, I absorbed the poetics of old school black nationalism. Rob Penny had not changed his name to Rob X or Rob L, Ali Shabazz or anything, but his kufi, dashiki, and black turtleneck classified him as your classic black arts poet, someone whose poetics were rooted in community more than a sense of self or a sensibility. And the poster child, or maybe poster father, of the black arts aesthetic was none other than the late Amiri Baraka. Baraka, formerly known as Leroy Jones, was a former liquid poet. So in this 2006 book, Beautiful Enemies, Andrew Epstein says it, you know, better than I can say it. So this is what Epstein says about Baraka. During a crucial 8-year period in the 1950s, as the 1950s turned into the 1960s, Baraka came to embody an exciting experiment in collaboration, friendship, and intertextuality across traditional boundaries of race. Few, if any, major African-American writers have ever been as thoroughly enmeshed in a community of white writers, lovers, and friends as Baraka, and few have so dramatically extricated themselves from this kind of interracial dialogue, so much so that, of course, like for the last 20 years, no one remembers that once upon a time he was Leroy Jones and, you know, again, a very fluid kind of poet. Baraka was for a period a liquid modernist, changing places, spouses, names, values, and orientations. So he changed from Jones to Baraka. He divorced his Jewish wife and married a sister. He moved from Greenwich Village up to Harlem after Malcolm X was killed. And then I wasn't sure how to say this because it's sort of not really, he had a sort of mysterious, ambiguous relationship with Frank O'Hara. Sometimes they slept in the same bed, but that doesn't mean they did anything. But it was a, you know, interesting relationship. So, but I don't want to get, you know, it's, I don't want to go on for libel or anything. And then his fluidity, and with it, I think his poetics solidified around the poetics of politics, the poetics of solidarity, the poetics, you know, of the 60s. I can admire the purposeful, socially oriented poetics that Baraka embraced. Such poetics can and have provided shelters and structures where people come together. A determined and functional sense of art is not itself a problem, but nor is it a solution to the challenges of being an individual prone to wondering outside those said structures and shelters. So I hope you hear what I'm saying. Like, I quite admire Baraka. He is a hero, even as I say, he did certainly solidify around, you know, a cause, and depending on your vantage, maybe that's a good cause, maybe it's a bad cause. In that other lecture was quite a bit about Baraka, but there, as is the case here, was far too little also about liquid women poets. I think of Sylvia Plath as a liquid poet, certainly Gwendolyn Brooks. Again, we could talk about that in the Q&A if you want to know more. Adrienne Rich, Audre Lorde, all were liquid. And it's just to say that when you try to, like, nail them down, you find that they evolved constantly in the work Austin resisted, a kind of like easy category. The idea of liquidness is not limited by race, class, or gender. The more oppressed or disenfranchised, the more important is one's liquidity. And again, I think Baraka might disagree with that. He might say, you know, the more oppressed, the more solid you need to be. But you can see sort of what I'm challenging here. The poets who have influenced me are or were liquid. Well, maybe that's not completely true. A few poets outside any manner of network have also had their influence. Wallace Stevens, for example, seems contrary to any notion of shifting adaptive poetics. Appropriately, in Stevens, water is not fluid, or it is only as fluid as snow. Snow was once liquid and will be again. Snow is everywhere in his poems, and as evidence, here is a cinto, which is just a poem built from the writings of other authors, that I wrote a few years ago, just sort of randomly, because I just kept being, before I knew I was going to do this talk, I was like, he sure writes a lot about snow. I know that means something. So then I just went through all his poems, and if there was a line with snow in it, I made a poem. This is just a short version of it to show you evidence of how often snow shows up. So this is a cinto. One must have a mind of winter to regard the frost and boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow. So maybe I should do like that. So these are all different poems, but it's just a line. One must have a mind of winter. There's a poem. To regard the frost and boughs of pine trees crusted with snow. Another line. The light in the room, more like a snowy air, reflecting snow, and roses, frail as April snow, passions of rain and moods in falling snow. The sea is in the falling snow, and the edges of the snow. It was snowing, and it was going to snow. The wise man avenges by building his city in snow. So that sounds like a poem by itself, but it's just all him. I think of that line, the wise man avenges by building his city in snow, as some manner of edict against change. I could also say it sounds racist to me. I just suspect it's racist. But let's just say it's something against change. The wise man avenges by building his city in snow. Stevens was not liquid in terms of his poetic network. That's unfortunately reflective in the story of his calling Gwendolyn Brooks a coon. Who's the coon, he said, looking at a picture of, or who let the coon in? There's different stories about what he said when he saw a picture of Gwendolyn Brooks. So that's not liquid. His sense of liquidity was not protean. It was icy and self-reflective. But can we consider him liquid in terms of imagination? Depends on your capacity for forgiveness. In my poem, Snow for Wallace Stevens. So what happened was, like, I decided to write my own poem, and the only thing that remains from the snow stuff is the poem is called Snow for Wallace Stevens, and that's in Lighthead. I'm not trying to get you to buy the book, but that's a whole other poem. But in that poem, I say, thus I have a capacity for love without forgiveness, and that's me trying to be a liquid poet when it comes to Stevens. Sometimes you can, and maybe you must, be influenced by even those who refuse to acknowledge you. It changes both you and them. I'm thinking of the reciprocal influence of the sort art critic Michael Baxendall describes in his 1985 book, Patterns of Intention or the Historical Explanation of Pictures. So here's a clearer example. Let's say two siblings spending an idle morning naming the ways their parents influenced them. And where the romantic sibling recalls unwavering passion, the practical sibling recalls steadfast formality. Where one recalls a house fluttering with gospel music each weekend, the other recalls only the yard full of yard birds and mowers. Thrift versus impulsiveness, the influence of chicken pot pie versus the influence of meatloaf, and so on. It is as if the parents are not more than two. Their influence is muddled, illusory, contradictory, and it's true. It is as if during the same vacation, one sibling toured the city with the parents at night, while the other was led by the parents through the city during the day. What is also true is that the parents are influenced by the children. So that's Baxendall's. That's a long way to try to talk about how Baxendall sees influence, that it's a two-way street. Baxendall says, each time an artist is influenced, he rewrites the art's history a little, talking about visual art. So I had to rewrite Stevens, hence the cinto made of his lines, to love him. But I don't forgive him. And more importantly, he doesn't care. I love this in Stevens too, that he does not pander to his audience. I suggest he even held a bit of disdain for his audience. the democracy of approval, consensus, accessibility. I suggest he valued the idiosyncratic reader. The individual reader in the company of a single poem has, if I rewrite Stevens correctly, a deeper patience and empathy. It is more personal, more fluid. That's what Stevens teaches me. Reading Stevens, I trust feeling more than meaning. I realize I do not believe it's the poet's job to mean. Feeling means more than meaning. So I don't want that to go to Stevens, though. That's me. That's what I think. Feeling means more than meaning. I realize I may only want to talk to poetry lovers. No one scolds a basketball player for talking little more than basketball. During the post-game interview, there are platitudes for God and mama, but the comments return invariably to basketball. It is what the basketball player knows. Basketball fans and players approve. So I realize I may only be interested in interested parties. I realize, for example, I have never loved tap dancing. I do not love the way tap dancers shuffle on their heels and toes, or that while doing so, they are often smiling and even worse sometimes, clapping as if to applaud the onlookers for looking. I realize, I hope nobody in here does tap dancing on the side. I realize a lecture should convey some manner of instruction. So here is an instruction. After reading a poem, reread it. Read it, then reread it, then read between the lines, then look at it, then watch it, then handle it like that jar of quivering water in Robert Bly's poem. I sat drinking Johnny Walker Blue with Dane after his first child was born. This was maybe 10 years after those Saturday community workshops. Rob Penny, rest in peace, was dead. Dane's dream of becoming a rapper was dead. So at nearly $300 a bottle, Johnny Walker Blue was nothing I could afford, but I had heard it was the drink Maya Angelou demanded backstage anytime she was invited to a reading. I'm not sure who mentioned it, probably some black tenure track poet who'd met Dr. Angelou at a university reading and been selected as the lucky one to pour Maya, as my kind of black folk called her, a short glass of the mythic magical elixir. I heard it was the equivalent of liquid heroin, and I knew as soon as I had the money, I was going to buy myself a bottle. I thought if I drank enough Johnny Walker Blue, I'd be able to leave my body. Maybe it would result in a poem, but of course that never happened. I have bought 2 bottles over these years. The last time I drank Johnny Walker Blue, I was morbidly blue and lonely, emptying the bottle in an empty room. But the first time I bought a bottle was around the same time Dane's daughter was born. Dane was my closest friend in Pittsburgh, like family. I'd had a thing with his sister. I can remember sucking her fingers once before we made love. This was the night she showed up on my doorstep, weeping and terrified. She'd been tied up by some thugs looking for Dane or Dane's stash of drugs. She's a lawyer now, so I shouldn't be telling you about any of this if I don't want to get sued. I gotta say, it makes me sweat. Let's call this an excerpt from a story called Poetic Liquids. That's what I was thinking, like, that was a liquid, that was poetic, that was a poetic liquid. Anyway, so I realized a lecture should convey some manner of insight, if not instruction. Here is an insight. The poem is a kind of house. I have been talking about poetics, that is to say, sensibility and tactic. But when I think of engaging the resulting poem, the actual poem, I think of houses. Some are bungalows, some are cabins, cottages, McMansions, etc. One enters through the front door and is housed in language. Each room is a tangible space possessed of furniture, a table, a coat rack, chairs, rugs, and the accoutrements of entertainment and distraction, a stereo, a television, books on a shelf. And should we find a couch in the kitchen, order says the couch must be moved to the den. When we think about what happens in poems. But how wonderful to find use for a couch in the kitchen, a fridge in the bathroom. Order demands we place the objects of our homes in all the expected places, But how wonderful to find your mother reclining on the couch while she stirs a pot of something delicious. If I tell you, my father often stared intently into an open refrigerator as he sat on the toilet, you might call the image surreal or whimsical or maybe gross. But long ago, my father was exiled to the lower quarters of the house, my mother's house. The whale snores that issued from his mouth when he slept made the pictures on the walls tremble. I thought the snores would kill him. I thought he might choke on dark air. My mother, guard of the house, a retired corrections officer, sentenced him to the room directly below her room. His pressed corrections officer uniforms, I suppose she retired after he got into the business. His three or four pairs of black prison guard shoes, yawning relief that my father's swollen feet were removed, a white sheet, and a dissonant floral quilt. My mother determined the floral fashion of the house. My mother decided the floral fashion of the furniture. My mother decided who slept where. She was our warden, unchallenged and benevolently indifferent and influential. Boxes of stubborn camouflage shirts from my father's time in the military, pants he'd long grown too fat to wear. A poem can be understood as a house. A house is a poem. So there's anecdotal evidence of Etheridge Knight's liquidness in his poem, Dark Prophecy, I Sing of Shine, where Shine, the iconic trickster of African-American folklore, is first to escape the sinking Titanic. So do y'all know this Shine in the Titanic? Some people will know it. It's like a toast. So Knight writes, and this is just an excerpt from the poem. The ship is sinking, and Shine is like, you know, he's like a brother on the ship. Yeah, I sing to thee of Shine, and how the millionaire banker stood on the deck and pulled from his pockets a $1 million check, saying, Shine, Shine, save poor me, and I'll give you all the money a black boy needs. How Shine looked at the money and then at the sea and said, jump in, motherfucker, swim like me. And Shine swam on, and Shine swam on. That's the point. It's more of it. It goes on like that. So this is how one should move in a liquid, modern liquid network. Shine swims between allegiances. When the banker's daughter runs naked on the deck, this is less of the point. There was some other language. I already said mother, so I could have kept going, but I thought she promises sex if Shine rescues her. And then Shine says, you got to swim, not to stay alive, which is ironic, of course. His motive is not power or prestige or sex. His motive is survival. He seeks whatever networks and harbors feed his freedom. His craft is fueled by craftiness and possibility, not ideology or allegiance. I've suggested that there are distinct liquid networks, you know, language poets, formalists, but in truth, it's all the same water. We say there are five oceans on the planet, but in fact, there's only one big ocean divided into Pacific, Atlantic, Indian, et cetera, for the sake of navigation and orientation and, of course, property. Influence does not or should not bother with the demarcations of property and border. It's really all the same water. So Shine, AKA Knight, offers a craft rooted in rootlessness. Poetics is sometimes considered synonymous with voice. I realize some people will have questions about how I found my voice and then, you know, how he or she might be able to find hers. I get these questions all the time. Don't ask them at the end. If you wrote that on a piece of paper, do not bring it up. How did you find your voice and how can I find mine? So you have a sense already, given my belief and influence and uncertainty, what I would say. So I have two reasons voice is nothing to pursue. Number one, voice is an intrinsic liquid. It's born in the blood. So wear all the masks you want, you can't get away from it. Number two, voice is an enigmatic fluid. It's too shifty to tie down. So wear all the masks you want, you can't get away from it. Listen to Prince sliding between a high-heeled baritone and a mustached falsetto. We always know it's him. It's not impossible to imagine it was actually Prince in disguise in Purple Rain. That's a whole other. We could have a long talk about that. Like, there is no Morris Day. It is not impossible to imagine Prince and Morris Day are the same person. Prince is a liquid modern man, shifting between names and styles, octaves and hairdos. He is a man shifting into and out of the voices he makes. And anyway, sounding like yourself is harder than you might imagine. I mean, do I have a black voice? And even if I do, it doesn't really give me a leg up. Blackness, like whiteness or Yankeeness or Southerness, is a useful starting place, but it is fortunately susceptible to influence and styles of variations. It is enriched by influence and styles of variation. The 90s era rapper Craig Mack, says in his one, it's an awesome line, and Flavor in Your Ear is really his only hit. He says in that song, my style is a style that ain't a style, so I can get buck wild. You should pull it up if you hadn't listened to Craig Mack in a while. It's still pretty good, even if it's only hit. The poetics of liquid is the poetics of wind. The poetics of liquid is the poetics of escape. The poetics of doors and windows. The poetics of liquid is the poetics of hallucination. It is the poetics of blood. It is the poetics of feeling. It is akin to the poetics of love. It is akin to the poetics of pleasure. The poetics of liquid is the poetics of hunger. The poetics of liquid is the poetics of the self. The poetics of liquid is the poetics of reflection, reflective minds and reflective mirrors. It is a place to reverse the place, a face to reverse the face. Poetics, like voice, can hold multiple registers and experiences and interest. Poetics, like a voice, are more than a reflection of identity, a word that both lacks the fluidity of sensibility and the intimacy of personality. Poetics are a reflection of a being being. So yes, I'm compelled by the idea of the poem as a house governed by a sort of feng shui-ish, which is Chinese for wind water, poetics. We enter the rooms, but we don't always consider the influence of spaces around and between the rooms, the basements where the id and intuition live, or the attic above the house where the big ideas and philosophies float. If a house is a poem, I describe my poetic taste as something like a yard with a fence I cannot see. If I leave my porch and walk over a few hills and meadows, cross a few rivers, I suspect I will find my fence, the border at which I will say what's inside is a poem and what's outside is not. I want to test that border. I want to straddle it. I want to remake it. But make, from the Greek word poetis, means maker, author, and it means poet. And this is how we arrive at Vico's verum factum, maker's knowledge. Giambattista Vico, 1668 to 1744, was an Italian rhetorician. So he offers a terrific counter to the Cartesian notion of being, Descartes. René Descartes' notion of knowledge prizes deductive reasoning and observation over perception. With Vico, it is not I think, therefore I am, which is Descartes, but it is I make, therefore I grasp. This is me making this up. So if you are a Vican, a real Vican, don't challenge me on it. For Vico, we can only know what we make, computers, cars, systems of government, but not what we do not make, the universe, the mind, the soul. Can the self be created? Does art create the self, or does art affirm the self? Vico offers a kind of knowledge that has room for uncertainty. Moreover, it suggests a way to engage art is to make art. The best way to grasp the wonder of poetry is to make poetry. And this is true. Long and hard, I consider giving you all a writing exercise instead of a lecture. And, you know, someday I'm going to do that. I think, you know, yeah, just let's just try to write something, and then you'll figure it all out. Making involves action, not observation. It involves wading into the restless liquid of language. So Vico provides an answer to Johnson's implicit question, where do good ideas come from? From other ideas. And where do good poems come from? From other poems. It is not enough to reach after uncertainty in the act of negative capability. One hopes to make something out of that uncertainty. Zygmunt Bauman proposes a fluidness that makes a practice of uncertainty and chance and risk. Liquidity makes one open not only to friendships and networks, but to everything everywhere. One's relationship to words and worlds is always anxiously in flux, but with unpredictability comes endless currents of potential, discovery, and inventiveness. Once on a panel about political poetry, an older co-panelist, a stalwart political poet, told me, after I said I distrusted dogma, edicts, generalities about anyone and anything, that everyone has to choose a side. Maybe he's right. When it comes to living, maybe he's right. But in art and poetry, choosing sides and styles congeals, hardens, and ends the conversation a poet should be having with the world. So here's a poem, The Blue Etheridge. Dear Parole Board of the Perennial Now, let me begin by saying it's very likely none of my ex-wives will vouch for me. You ever seen the Mississippi? Whenever I see brown hills and red gullies, I remember what the world was like before I twisted spoons over flames. I pissed from a bridge the day I left. Yes, sir, I've changed. But I won't be telling you the story of the forlorn Negro or the Negro cutthroat or the Negro hero or the Negro Tom. I won't be telling you the story of the night I died. I believe everything comes back to music or money, belly song, song of the 12-fingered fix, song of the Gemini women. I know I'm cursed. I sang out to the Baptists I saw gathered on the riverbanks the day I left. I sang out to the reed straight as tongues and the salmon in the waters of my people. And beyond that, I sang out to my barreled back shadow damming the stream. So with the publication of my most recent book, I realized a poem influenced by Etheridge Knight has appeared in every other book I've written. I didn't know it until this last book. In my debut was Poet Dying at the Window, a poem in conversation with Knight's love poem, As You Leave Me. And in my third book was The Blue Etheridge, the poem I just shared with you, persona poem. Tonight, the ending image of that poem seems pertinent. Knight on a bridge above the waters of change, while his own barreled-back shadow aims to still the waters, says something about the desire for movement as well as resolution. The two paradoxical gestures equal uncertainty. I realize I am not so interested in resolving the conflict between influence and invention so much as acknowledging the blurred space between them. The only thing stronger than my joy is my hunger for joy. It's a fact the bones of the horse last longer than the horse. These are lines from Self-Portrait as Etheridge Knight in the style of A Crime Report, a poem in the most recent book. It's not a poem I've ever read aloud or know how to read aloud, as it is really in the shape of an actual crime report. Poems can take the shape not only of other poems, but of all other forms, recipes, glossaries, PowerPoints, obituaries. Just as metaphor is based on comparisons and links, so too all of poetry is about synthesizing, transforming, bridging, and linking. Like water, it does not give in so much as give away and give away. Poetry is where we influence and are influenced by what influences us. Poetry is where we shape and take the shape of what shapes us. I am calling this the poetics of liquid. That's it, y'all.
Thank you, Terrence.
Yeah, that was like 50 minutes, but with 5 minutes of ad-libbing. So.
If you have a question, please write on a card and pass it to an usher. Terrence, I'm curious what your process for writing these talks has been, and if it's similar or dissimilar to your process for writing poetry.
That's a good question. Is it different? I'm like, do I have a process? I don't know if I actually have a process. I think I just write. I think it's a process of failing and excavation of like layers and putting stuff in and taking stuff out. So in that way, yeah, that essay is actually in numbered sections that I didn't read, but I am working on that idea that I can sort of drop associations down inside a kind of like tangible
argument. I don't know whether, again, maybe it's confusing, but it's something like I got to do it to kind of like make it as much like a poem or the process of my own thinking as possible. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Has writing the talks inspired poems, or conversely, have ideas or lines from poems found their way into the talks?
No. Even though I've been talking all the way about liquid, I do like to separate things quite, you know, way too much, in fact. You know, I do like box things off. So they've been very, very separate processes. Although, like, that whole section about, like, the Johnny Walker Blue, as I looked at that, and that's why I said it, you know, that could be a story. I could see behind that entire thing a whole other, which is really the challenge, I think, of prose. Every sentence can yield, you know, a dozen other sentences. So, but I didn't, you know, go too deep into those associations, but I just sort of wanted to acknowledge them as much as possible. But generally, no, they're very separate.
What have you learned about Etheridge Knight through writing about him in the lecture form that you think you might not have learned about him in writing in the poem form?
That's a good question, too. I mean, just many, many more questions emerge as I think about him. I mean, he is a kind of a muse. He's just been there at the beginning. And there's another essay I talk about, like, my missed opportunity to meet him. So he was there at the beginning, and it's sort of important in a lot of different kinds of ways. But I think, you know, I guess I can answer that in terms of what this essay is doing, which is really thinking about his liquidness. I mean, I knew that was what he represented to me before I knew it, like that he wasn't writing one kind of poem, that he was a black arts poet, but he seemed much too loose and much too wild to sort of always be on that bus. He would get on it and then get off of it. And that seemed, I don't know which came first, if like looking at Etheridge Knight taught me a way to sort of be on the bus without being on the bus, or if I was already like that and I sort of attached myself to him because that's what he represented.
How do you, or I think you were speaking about this a bit at the end, but could you say more about how you encourage uncertainty and liquidity in your own work, or how you encourage your students to practice liquidity?
Sure. Yeah. Well, it would be like a better example before the end is like Wallace Stevens, because certainly for me, he promotes both like admiration and disdain simultaneously. Mm-hmm. So I think that space is uncertainty, and yet sort of wrestling with them constantly. I certainly learn things about language, even if I'm not always learning things about the same things that I would learn from Baraka or the things I learned in that sort of weekend workshop. So I'm just trying to put both those things together. Mm-hmm. So I would say, yeah, there wasn't that much uncertainty promoted in the kind of like politics of solidarity or sort of late Baraka, but I could get that elsewhere. I certainly could get that in Stevens and then try to figure out, you know, how to make a new conversation out of those two things.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Lowell as an example of someone who lived liquidly. Yeah. And is there a tension, do you think, between practicing uncertainty but also living a stable life? I mean, right, we have to have stability as well.
Sure.
So, you know, where's that tension?
Well, that was what I was alluding to both about his wife. He did it all the time. I mean, his book, Afterlife Studies, is like Imitations. Mm-hmm. So the question is like, so like my favorite Lowell line, I myself am hell. I always thought that was like, you could get that on a t-shirt, you know. But it actually is not him. He stole it from Milton, you know. And he doesn't say it. It's not any book that I've seen. But, you know, it is from Milton. So it's like, well, now the best line I like of his is actually from Paradise Lost. He also says, my mind's not right, which could be on the front, you know. My mind's not right. And on the back, I myself am hell. That would be a good t-shirt. So, but yeah, it's why ultimately I think I go more towards Knight as a model, because I sort of think of Lowell as fairly cool. I mean, he's not like, Sylvia Plath is hot, but he's fairly cool. So his poems aren't especially influential, but I could see what he was doing. I could see how, like, because of him, we get something like Confessionalism and something like Sylvia Plath, you know. So I see his role in it, even if the poems themselves aren't fire.
How do you know when one of your poems is good? Or when editing The Best American Poetry, what were your metrics for a keeper?
When one of my poems are good, let's go with that one first. I mean, you can always sort of edit them, so I guess they're never really. I know the poems that people like, but maybe I don't even use those terms. I think like engagement interest, dialogue, and that's how I would get to that other question about the best American poetry. Like, best just means, best is not that far from, like, diverse, as I think of it. Just like, oh, this is something I haven't seen before. This is making me think more diversely about what poems can do or where poems can go. So that's not the same thing as good, although they often line up, I think. I mean, again, there's business models for that, like how diversity is the best way for invention. I think that's what where good ideas come from, sort of pursues that idea. So I am sort of suggesting that's actually not the point. Like, is it good isn't always the point. It's more like, is it engaging? Is it, which is how we get to the conversation about basketball players and saying, like, how much of my work in the lecture is really to persuade and argue with you. I don't like that part of the lecture. I like the series of realizations and not really coming down with any kind of like kernel of fact or kernel of kind of a thesis. So that maybe makes that not a lecture. I don't know what it makes it, but that's what I was wrestling with.
How does the poetics of liquid affect how you think about gathering and shaping a book?
I don't think I had. I mean, so again, I mean, I was really interested in liquid modernity, and as I said, Vico too, which just gets a little sort of glimpse at the end of it. But I find this is why I think of myself as a much better reader than writer. Like I feel like the reading just is always sort of endless, but writing, I feel like I'm always at the last poem. Like I don't know if I can do this again. The last book, that might be the last book. But reading, it's like, oh, Vico, let me go see what this guy's talking about. Liquid modernity. He's got all these books on liquid life and liquid fear. You know, so that sort of yields endless kinds of ideas. And then I'm just associating, which still goes back to influence. I'm allowing this idea that was already in the world influence what I was doing and gives me a way to kind of shape that idea, hence the reciprocal relationship of influence. You know, just because I didn't know Vico doesn't mean I wasn't a Vican, as this guy said I was. And I thought, like, okay, sure, yeah, that's what I am.
Have you ever made any poetry comics? This person comments, that seems like as a visual artist and a poet, that would be an amazing form for you.
I can only like do, this is true, you could take this how you want it. I can only really do everything like one time. So like in, I was good in track, but only because it was like dash and stop, you know. But like going around more than once was very, very boring. So that's why I can't do comics, because the repetitiveness of it, I just lose interest very quickly. So like a poem painting, which I've done, one image, a few lines, set. But as soon as you ask me to do it again, I'm like, you know, that becomes a challenge, yeah.
You and I were talking earlier today about the increasing number of books of poetry that incorporate the visual in some way, like Mattia Harvey's book.
Sure.
That was, you know, she spoke here in the fall. Why do you think we're seeing this, and do you have hopes for where that might go, that the intersection of the visual and the poetic?
Well, also exciting that y'all have Alison Bechdel coming. Didn't you say she was coming?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the other part of that conversation I would highlight earlier was just the idea that clearly we're developing a new appreciation for comics and graphic novels. And in an interesting way, our academic networks haven't caught up. So to say like, well, if I have nothing against like going to school. So if I wanted to finally learn how to do like a graphic novel and write the said comic poetry, where would I go if I decided I couldn't do it myself? So maybe in a few years, someone will be teaching these things and you can go somewhere and learn it on the weekend. But presently there isn't. But we know that that's true, that people's value of what comics can do and what graphic novels can do has shifted. Our language, our understanding has shifted. And yet everybody that's doing it is really self-taught. They're really sort of on an island figuring it out, which isn't all bad. But am I answering your question? Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm not answering your question. Mm-hmm. There's some relationship there, yeah.
You said at the end of your lecture that you had considered giving us a writing exercise instead of a lecture. If you had done that, what might it have looked like?
Oh, I have a good one. I should save that for the next lecture. But so there's this poem. I saw this poem, and I do this exercise, so you would have to find the poems or email me. A poem by Dean Young is in Dean Young's 2010 book, Skid. So when I read that poem, I thought it was like Dean Young's best poem ever. So it's like a poem by Dean Young in Dean Young's book. And it was a good poem. And then a few years later, a poem by Mary Ruffel showed up in Mary Ruffel's book. And the thing that I'm giving away, when I give this assignment, we look at the poems, we talk about them, and then you sort of do some prompts. Mm-hmm. But then you have to give all your prompts to someone else. Because the truth is, a poem by Dean Young was written by Mary Ruffel and then put in Dean Young's book. And a poem by Mary Ruffel was written by Dean Young and then put in her book. So the conversation is just about, like, whose voice is it anyway? And, you know, people always go into these long spiels about gender when they see the poems, how they're different because a man would do this and a woman would do that. And they're always wrong at the end when I say, well, actually, you know. So that's a good one. I should have given you another example because I love that exercise. But that's one that I use a lot to talk about influence. And it's a kind of a collaborative poem. Mm-hmm. And it almost always loosens people up. Yeah.
What does your desk look like? What is on it?
A Café Du Monde. Do those little orange mm-hmm. Café Du Monde canisters with mm-hmm. pens in it. And a box with cigarette stuff in it. Tobacco and paper. I only smoke in my office. So, is this recorded? Is this being recorded? And then usual stuff, a printer. Above it, though, is like a picture of David Bowie and John Coltrane and this group that I mentioned, Kaveh Kanem, mm-hmm. Africa, mm-hmm. a picture my daughter did. That's now, I think I've been smoking around it too long now. It's like, oh, I should have put that thing in a frame. But anyway, so, mm-hmm. yeah, you know, those are our guys. You know, Miles Davis was very liquid, I think. Mm-hmm. Maybe even, I mean, I think there were big shifts in John Cole. David Bowie is very liquid. Mm-hmm. So again, like, once I got the term and began to think about just applying it to people that I like. Before, I didn't know why I liked these guys. Mm-hmm. I just liked them. But of course, in this frame, I said, like, oh, of course I like Miles Davis and David Bowie and, you know, other folks. So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Terrence, for being here for a wonderful lecture. Thanks, thank you guys. All for coming out. Terrence will be signing books over here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And we'll see you next year.
I break all rules with my actions. That the vaccines, the MC, stop relaxing.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you like what you've heard, you might give us a good review. It'll help other listeners find us. Terrence Hayes appeared at Chihuly Garden and Glass in the Seattle Center on May 5, 2015. He presented his lecture, The Poetics of Liquid. This event was presented by Seattle Arts and Lectures, the Bagley Wright Lecture Series on Poetry, the Seattle Times, and KUOW 94.9. Thanks again to Anna Tatashev for our recording. Stay tuned for more great talks. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.